Welcome to the Washington Updates podcast from the National Association of Health Underwriters. President Trump delivered his State of the Union address this week, claiming to have repealed the core of the ACA by eliminating the law's individual mandate penalties through the tax reform package signed into law last year. Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman join us for this week's podcast to examine the progress that has been made over the past year, where the current agenda stands, and what's to come in the months ahead. President Trump delivered his first official State of the Union address this week, highlighting his administration's efforts to undo the ACA. Looking back on his first joint session address to Congress last February, how would you describe the progress that has been made?
Happy to be with all of you and talk about this latest week's worth of healthcare. So President Trump had his first State of the Union. All the pomp and circumstance that takes place of the cabinet and others coming in. And he claimed a victory on repealing essentially the ACA, the individual mandate. One thing I would note, a caution, is, and the talk points from the White House repeatedly have said, the individual mandate is gone. It is actually here, as I'm sure all of you know. And so any of your clients who are using healthcare for this year and make sure they don't cancel their plans, or you could still get stuck with that tax penalty. But it was exciting. It's always an exciting time in Washington during the State of the Union.
Yeah, unfortunately, we here at NEHU are sticklers for the details and for making sure everyone is in compliance. So saying that the ACA was repealed through the State of the Union was about as accurate as it was when he said that after the House bill passed in May and they had the Rose Garden ceremony. But there were some things that did happen over the past year that they did make progress on. Chris did mention the repeal of the individual mandate penalty just starting in 2019, so not in 2018. And we have seen some conversations starting on other market stabilizers that I think we'll touch on in a bit. But what was included in the State of the Union this week, it was, I think they said, one of the third longest speeches. We will try not to make this our third longest podcast about it. But there was the mention of trying to control prescription drug costs and also looking at the opioid crisis.
Yeah, I think with the State of the Union, couple reading the tea leaves of it, by declaring victory on the individual mandate and repeal and replace, I think it's a sign that means this coming year, there's not really going to be another run at the repeal and replace efforts.
I agree.
And so I think that conversation's kind of come to a close, and maybe it opens an opportunity for some of the more market stabilization things that we're looking at. They did talk a lot about the prescription drugs, and I think that prescription drug topic is going to be hot, but I'm still looking for something concrete of what that actually means.
Right. We haven't heard exactly what this plan is specifically on the prescription drugs, but it has been repeated often, especially in the past couple of months, and now emphasized even more with the confirmation and swearing in of Alex Azar as Secretary of HHS. Of course, as you all know, he was a former executive at Eli Lilly, and before that was high up in HHS under the Bush administration, so definitely has a background with the policy there. However, we haven't gotten any specifics on exactly how he's going to oversee this mission to lower drug prices.
One of the things the president did talk about with drugs is right to try legislation. Right to try allows patients to ask a pharmaceutical company to try one of their drugs that they might be testing. I think this is wildly popular out there because who doesn't want to have a fighting chance at finding a cure? I think from the pharmaceutical company's point of view and also from the scientific point of view, they don't want to do anything that will ruin their trials and testing drugs or anything that will limit the ability to actually put that drug widely on the market over the long run. And I'll be curious to see if this right to try legislation, A, actually passes it. It's already passed the Senate. It's before the House now. But B, if it actually makes a difference, because all it is the right to ask a pharmaceutical company if you can try the drug. It's not actual access to the drug. But it is very popular provision, and so we'll see how that goes over the next couple of months.
Republicans held their annual winter retreat and appear to have the same lack of consensus that bogged their healthcare agenda last year. Where does repeal and replace stand looking ahead in 2018?
Well, I think as we mentioned, just comparing the speech for the State of the Union this year to President Trump's comments at the beginning of the year in 2017 when we're looking at repeal and replace in the context of the Republicans and their annual winter retreat. This year, we are still having a lot of the same issues that they had last year when they were trying to approach repeal and replace. And I think it has gotten worse for them to try to create this mainstay of doing a full repeal and replace. I don't think that we're going to see that in 2018. I think that they know that they're not going to see that in 2018. And so trying to come together on a consensus of what they all can agree on would be almost a replace for repeal and replace, if we want to get a little cheeky with it. What exactly that would be for them, that would still be in the win column for the Republicans when we're looking at their healthcare agenda.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So the Republicans are at the Greenbrier in West Virginia, and they're doing their retreat, both the House and the Senate, together this year. And Vice President Pence and President Trump are visiting and giving speeches. But when you look at that agenda that includes the president and the vice president, there's no healthcare speakers on the entire agenda. There's speakers about immigration, there's speakers about infrastructure. But I think it's telling that there are no speakers about healthcare on the agenda for their retreat. And again, like the State of the Union, I take this as another tea leaf of what they really want to focus on. But I don't necessarily see that as a bad sign for us, because I actually think some of the issues we want to work on, like market stability and others, really work better in a less polarized environment where there's a lot of attention, where there's tweets, where there's cable news coming in. I think it makes it harder to find compromise. But if these issues go a little below the radar, a little less publicly confrontational, we might have a better shot at making some real changes legislatively this year and regulatorily.
I think healthcare is the elephant in the room at the winter retreat, and it's something that they're not trying to make too many efforts to be public about of what they're discussing when it goes on here. But I also do agree with Chris that I think because of this, and because there's not going to be a huge push on repeal and replace, it may make it easier for us to gain some traction with many of our bipartisan bills that kind of chip away at some of the different pieces of the ACA that need to be either repealed or improved upon.
It is increasingly looking like any market stability efforts will focus on reinsurance. What is the most likely route for this legislation to be passed and signed into law?
So we are hearing more and more conversation about reinsurance. We think that's a good sign because we haven't had really a good conversation about reinsurance over the last 4 years. Right now in the House, there is legislation that House Energy and Commerce Committee members have, Republican side members have come out with. It basically takes the fund that was available in the AHCA, the repeal and replace package that the House passed, and recreates that fund going out there. Now, I have a few concerns. It's less money than actually was available in the AHCA. And one of the problems with this fund is it's available to the states for more than just reinsurance. There's so many problems going on out there, but we really need a dedicated fund to reinsurance. And this fund that's created also could be used for opioid abuse. Don't get me wrong, opioid abuse is a huge problem in this country. But you can't allow this fund to be for everything. This fund can also be used for maternity care. This fund can also be used for preventive medicine. There's just too many uses of this fund. But I am encouraged to see that reinsurance is actually on the House Republican agenda. This is not something we've seen before. Generally speaking, reinsurance in the last year conversation has come from the Senate side, particularly Senator Susan Collins, who along with Senator Nelson have a reinsurance bill. There's lots of questions on how to make this work. Do you have a 50-state plan where each state needs to apply these funds? Are we talking about reinsurance from a national point of view? Also, how do you distribute these funds? Are we talking about a high-risk pool in the old-fashioned sense of the word, where you're actually taking people out, grouping them together, maybe charging them more in premiums, but then providing some assistance? Or one of these more hybrid high-risk pool, invisible risk pool situations where you're allowing carriers to have a backstop to, say, fund their insurance policies when somebody has $1 million worth of claims?
And some of the other concerns that folks have with both the House and the Senate bills here. So on the House side, I think it's about $30 billion over 3 years is what they're looking at. And to Chris's point that it can be used for more than just reinsurance in the states, it is under the discretion of the Secretary of HHS to distribute these funds and what it can be used for. So it's not just that there's a long list available in the bill, it also opens it up to be even more encompassing, being under the discretion of the secretary, which again looks to the point of whether these funds will actually be used for reinsurance purposes. The House bill does fund the CSRs for 2017 retroactively, so we would be in favor of that going back and funding the cost-sharing reductions. However, that is also included in some other bills, so trying to look at it at a more holistic manner. On the Senate side, with Collins and Nelson, they are looking at using the 1332 waivers as a process for states to apply for these funds. And with this, there's some criticism there that having to use the 1332 waiver system is a very slow process, and it will slow down the progress of trying to get the funds into the states. So that's a criticism with that piece. And then there's also a criticism from Republicans that because they're using the 1332 waiver system through the Collins-Nelson bill to fund these reinsurance plans, that it is still technically using pieces of the ACA. And so it's tied too much to Obamacare by using the 1332 waivers, and that many in the party would like to see the funds distributed through another manner. I do think, however, that we have gotten to the place where reinsurance isn't so much of a dirty word anymore. When last year, I think many of you will remember at Capitol Conference, we were really shying away from the use of that term because it was seen as an insurer bailout. And we were talking more about stability funds, which did the same thing, but were just called something else. But now we are seeing folks on the Hill embracing the term of reinsurance. So it is creating, I think, a different type of conversation around this issue.
Yeah, I think in the Senate side, we'll obviously continue to see Chairman Alexander and Ranking Member Murray take the lead on these market stability issues. They do work together very well. I think the question has always been for Alexander Murray, not that they couldn't figure out how to stabilize the market. It's more of a question, can they get everybody else to vote along with them to stabilize the market? Cost-share reductions is what we talked about as part of it. I think we are in an interesting situation now that the cost-sharing reductions have gone away and the carriers have priced their products accordingly. You're in an interesting situation that as the prices have gone up, there's now the situation where, based on your tax credits, you might be eligible for a bronze plan for free or near free, where you weren't before when the cost-sharing reduction payments were being made. And so there is this situation where some people below 400% of poverty in certain states are actually doing better and getting more health insurance coverage than they were before. So I think you have to look at putting those cost-sharing reduction back in. How does it affect those sorts of people who now have been actually able to really have a bronze plan covered where they haven't before? And I think that sort of complicated some of the discussions and negotiations between Senator Murray and Senator Alexander of trying to make sure those people don't get hurt. And next year we're saying, oh, I know you've been getting your bronze plan for only a small cost each month. We'd like to increase that cost next year.
And so Alexander Murray is on the Senate side, and of course, we will be awarding them the Spirit of Independence Award at Capitol Conference this year for their leadership and the bipartisan direction that they're trying to take in Congress to try to get some type of market stabilization in place. So we're really excited about awarding them with what is our biggest award that we give out to folks outside of the insurance industry, and are hoping to have them there. On the House side, we will be having the co-chairs of the Problem Solvers Caucus on the House side, Representatives Gottheimer and Reed, joining us for Capitol Conference this year. And they'll be there to talk about the market stabilization efforts on the House side, aside from the reinsurance bill. So the Problem Solvers Caucus is looking at, once again, funding those cost-sharing reduction payments, ways that they can be more flexible on 1332 waivers. And one piece that they have that's really different that we haven't seen prior is not to eliminate the employer mandate, but to change it from requiring employers to provide insurance from those that are 50 plus to 500 and over. So we're really interested in having them sit down with us and chat about their pieces of legislation for market stability. And I hope you all will join us and be there for Capitol Conference to see that.
The Trump administration released their latest Medicare Advantage guidance and will be reconsidering the changes to the Employer Group Welfare Plans, or EGWPs. How has NAHU worked to influence this process?
So NEHU has obviously worked with CMS directly on years over many notices. This is particularly the rate notice. Came out with a 1.8% rate for Medicare Advantage plans. This is the reimbursement rate that the carriers actually get for operating a Medicare Advantage plan. Obviously, if carriers are not reimbursed or can't afford to stay in the market, they won't offer a plan. If they don't offer a plan, our agents and brokers don't have anything to offer and to work with seniors. So there is a symbiotic relationship of making sure that MA plans are available and affordable and the carriers can continue to offer them. EGWP, fun little word. I enjoy the term quite a bit. But basically, this is the employer-based Medicare Advantage plans. So some companies used to obviously do retirement health benefits, and that was very popular. But as time has gone on, we all know that's pretty expensive to continue to provide health benefits for your retired employees. And so a lot of them over time have paid for Medicare Advantage plans for their employee retirees. It's a little less cost for a company who might be doing this, but still providing health care for their retirees in that sort of balanced nature where it's not costing quite as much. So it has the little acronym EGWP, and basically that's about 20% of the overall Medicare Advantage market is EGWP. And we have seen proposals from the Obama administration over time to really cut back on the reimbursements around EGWP Medicare Advantage programs, which is concerning because people are now retired and relying upon these plans, and will employers in the future just decide to give up on retiree health care altogether?
Right. And as Chris mentioned, during the Obama administration, we had several proposed rules and regulations that came out regarding the EGWPs, which NEHU did comment on, and really here focusing on making sure that there's still choice and availability left in the market for those employer group plans. We will continue to have that same stance as we're going forward with the Trump administration. We don't foresee any huge cutbacks in this market for right now, but we will continue to monitor it and work with our Medicare Working Group and FMO Council as we're looking through these newly proposed rates.
Finally, looking at a broader picture on the future of healthcare, Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JPMorgan Chase announced plans to radically reform their employer-based healthcare plans. What does this mean for the future of employer-based benefits?
Well, I'm not sure they even know what this means for the future of their employer-based health plans. This announcement came out and there was still some uncertainty about exactly what the intent was of what they will be doing in the future. So they have, I think, over a million employees that they're looking at possibly bringing in-house their health insurance. And so instead of going outside and using a carrier and going into the employer-sponsored market where their risk is shared with several other employers, bringing that in where they're sharing that risk just among themselves. Whether this is going to be a trend of what employers are going to do is yet to be seen. There's also the question of whether Amazon is getting into the prescription pharmaceuticals and whether that will play a role into all of this. And I think many of those details are still left to be sorted out. It does add to the list, though, of a lot of different groups that are either saying they want to be a little bit more creative with their employer-based healthcare or with looking at some mergers in the health insurance industry that we've seen over the past few months.
Yeah, so everybody's been waiting for Amazon to make some move in healthcare for quite some time now. Either pharmaceuticals actually becoming an insurer. I've heard all sorts of rumors that they would start to buy hospitals. It's Amazon. They probably can do what they want to do. But this particular proposal is interesting. So obviously Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JPMorgan are self-insurers already. But they self-insure their plans, but often use a carrier for their doctor networks and other hospitals, prescription drugs, benefits. And so while they self-insure, there's still the employees get a card that might say Aetna or somebody else on it. So it'll be curious to see if they truly mean that they are going to try to go completely on their own. There are ways of obviously truly looking at bending the cost curve and cost of healthcare. This is why so many people self-insure as opposed to, say, why aren't they in the large group market or something like that. So, but a lot of people have tried and failed at this sort of idea in the past. But you do have some great minds at Amazon Berkshire Hathaway and the JP Morgan. We are talking about people with a lot of skill, a lot of technology available out to them. Will there be ways of helping their employees better shop for healthcare, better shop between the hospitals, better shop for doctors? You know, the lack of transparency in the healthcare system has been something at NHU we've talked about for quite some time, and consumers really have a lot of difficulty to make any sort of price-based decisions, or from that, not just that matter, price-based, but really even quality-based decisions, that often we make decisions and decide that the high-quality one must be the most expensive one, which is not really true. Can Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JP Morgan create something for their employees to better navigate the system and end up saving their employees' money and their company's money for healthcare in the long run? Remains to be seen, but it's an interesting market disruptor, and with these three companies involved, I'm sure it will get plenty of press.
I think it also just indicates the business world's frustration with the stagnation that we do have in Congress and the failure for action to take place to address a lot of these concerns about cost and transparency. And so the business world is taking it on themselves and trying to figure it out. And this is something that everyone's going to watch, and we'll definitely be keeping our fingers on the pulse for it.
Yeah, I think when you're looking at it, the self-insurance market overall has been able to make a lot of the changes that eventually come down and you see in the large group or the small group market or the individual market. A lot of the work on value-based design that we've been working on at NHU really happens in the self-insurance market. So we're always interested to see market disruptors here and ways of actually improving healthcare and making it more affordable without having to have government intervention of a single-payer sort of system out there. So these are hopefully ways that bend the cost curve by allowing employees to have more choice.
That is all the time we have for this week's episode. We'd like to thank Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman for joining us for the Washington Update podcast from the National Association of Health Underwriters. Thank you for listening.